You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer. Australians take higher education very seriously. It's the country's third biggest export, and its researchers are among the most highly cited in the world, despite the fact that the country's population is about two-thirds of the UK's and just over a tenth of the US's. And because of its small size, it's often said to be punching above its weight in international student recruitment and in research fields like renewable energy and biodiversity. But it's not always no wakas in Australian higher education. This week I speak with our Asia Pacific editor, John Ross, about recent funding cuts to the research allocation, and to Anna Deletic, Pro Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of New South Wales, Sydney's, to hear firsthand how it's affecting researchers. First up, though, here's John Ross. John, hi.
Good morning, or good evening.
Morning for me, evening for you.
That's right.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak with me on a late Monday evening. We've got the Research Excellence Summit coming up at the University of New South Wales, Sydney next week. So I wanted to take the opportunity to just speak with you a little bit about the research landscape in Australia so that we can get a bit of an update, because there have been quite a few things, some pretty provocative developments happening within that landscape in the past couple of months. So I'm wondering if you could just start out by telling us a little bit about funding, which had a big upset just before Christmas. Is that right?
That's right. And funding's never far from discussions about research. There are a lot of good things on the horizon for research in Australia. The government sort of earmarked a lot of money for big-scale infrastructure. Some people are worried that the money isn't really committed into what they call the back years, forward estimates, or after 4 years, which in effect means the government hasn't technically put the money away for it. But there's a fair amount of optimism that this infrastructure will be paid for. We're talking about something like 1.9 billion Australian dollars over 10 years. That's mm-hmm. about 1.1 billion quid. Dozens of research and access networks, an Antarctic agency, telescopes, research vessels, biocontainment laboratory, particle accelerators, all this big, expensive stuff. And there is optimism. There's been a lot of worry for years that this stuff wouldn't be adequately provided for. Now there's a fair bit of optimism about that. There's also a lot of optimism about something called the Medical Research Future Fund, which, when it's fully funded, it's a $20 billion nest egg. It's going to be the biggest sovereign future fund of its kind in the world, as I understand. In effect, doubling Australia's investment in medical research. And researchers will start seeing money sort of trickling through initially and then hopefully flooding through over the next few years. So all that's the good news. Mm. The bad news, and there's always some bad news, is cuts that were announced just before Christmas, or essentially freezing of a couple of fairly important funding programs, which is another way of saying a cut. The background to this is back in November, Dan Tehan, who's the fairly new Minister for Education. He's got a regional focus. He comes from regional Victoria himself. And he announced something like $135 million funding for various regional initiatives for higher education. And that all sounded good, but it pretty soon became apparent there was a bit of a sting in the tail with all this, which was at that point an unspecified sort of cut or freezing of a research fund. And just before Christmas, in the mid-year budget update, researchers found out just how big that sting was. In effect, it's more than twice the size of the regional higher education bonus, something in the order of $329 million. So freezing of a couple of schemes, the research support program and the research training program. So the first pays for things like indirect costs, keeping the lights on in the lab, paying for support staff, that sort of stuff. And the latter pays for things like scholarships for PhD students. So, in effect, researchers can look forward to having all this fantastic kit. They can look forward to a lot more money, particularly for medical research projects, but less money to pay to keep the lights on, to pay to have PhD students to be parts of these projects, pay for lab assistance and so forth. Mm. So it's a bit of a seesaw situation.
Yeah, and of course this came just a couple months after the Simon Birmingham revelation that he had vetoed funding for 11 humanities research projects, kind of breaking with protocol because they had been recommended by the Australia Research Council. I mean, the two aren't necessarily related, but I don't know, how has the sector responded to these two back-to-back announcements?
Well, I suppose, yeah, this is going back a few months now, but it was almost a symbolic middle finger being extended to the sector in a sense. I think it was, the feeling amongst researchers is this was always going to get out, and eventually it did in a Senate estimates hearing, and there was uproar, more for the symbolic side of it than the actual amounts involved, which were, I can't remember, some $1 million in total. I mean, a major impact for the people who were directly involved, and these are all humanities researchers, because getting some of these some funding is almost like winning the lottery when you're looking at success rates of something in the order of 15%. So to have that rug ripped out from underneath you at the very last moment is a really nasty cut for the people who are involved.
Mm.
But in essence, I suppose it was the government's way of saying, you know, we have control here, and if you get a little bit too crazy and blasty with some of the research you're coming out with, you know, we might not go along with that, and we'll invoke the sort of the pub test, you know, what would the average Australian think about, you know, some of these projects with fairly obscure titles. It was a symbolic hit to the sector, and I think it really shocked some people because this hasn't happened, or at least hasn't emerged. So this has happened for a good 10 years.
Right.
And generally, governments don't sort of get involved at that level of detail.
Right. Interesting. And then the start of the year began with a kind of a nudge, a very forceful nudge from Michelle Simmons, who's a professor of physics and the Australian of the Year, telling researchers basically to think big and to extend their ambitions within Australia. Where did that come from, and what do you think she meant by that?
Michelle Simmons is good at giving the sector a nudge. She's given us plenty of nudges over the years. She's nudged young women not to feel limited in the area of STEM and not to subscribe to mythology of girls aren't good at maths and physics and things like that. She herself, you know, proves that that's not the case. She's also given a real push in terms of the way schools handle things like maths and not to get too sort of too wordy, too much in favour of words as opposed to numbers as a way of trying to make things like maths and physics more palatable, particularly, again, to girls, saying that's in danger of kind of dumbing down maths and physics. So they're the sorts of, I think they're some of the things that she was saying which made her really noticed and contributed to her being named Australian of the Year last year. These messages that she's given us. She's just completed a tenure as Australian of the Year, which is probably good news for her because it means she can roll the sleeves back up and get stuck into her real love, which is quantum physics and trying to develop a quantum computer based in silicon. She's really leading the charge for that. She's British by birth. She came here about 20 years ago. It's kind of lured to Australia by this feeling that Australians don't take themselves too seriously, but they're willing to try something new. And so I guess she's kind of reminding Australian researchers of that Australian quality in a sense. She's sort of saying, all these problems we have with funding, they're true, but at the same time, we really have it pretty good here in Australia. You know, she's talking about schemes like Australia's Centres of Excellence. You know, she runs one that's based at the University of New South Wales. Systems of research fellowships, which really sort of create opportunities for young researchers that I think that she thinks are unequaled in places like North America and Europe. In North America, things are just too sort of fragmented and local, and the young sort of early career researchers don't get those sorts of opportunities, although I think North America's really trying to emulate some of the Australian programs. And in Europe, she talks about bureaucracy. So she came here because she thought there were opportunities here that just didn't exist
back
at home. And she's found that those, you know, she's thrived, obviously, since she's been here. So it's a bit of a fillip, I guess. You know, we talk a lot about funding here, and there's a lot of woe is me, and obviously it's justified given the ups and downs that the sector experiences. But at the same time, we have to recognise the strengths that we have to play with.
Mm. Another story that you've covered recently for THE is looking at the number of foreign PhD students that are studying in Australia. Can you remind us what the issue is there?
Look, I think this is probably something that would resonate with North America and Europe. A former deputy vice chancellor at the University of Melbourne, who's really doing a lot of work, doing sort of big picture analysis sort of pieces for the sector now, Frank Larkins. His most recent analysis looks at the makeup of doctoral students. You know, mostly these are PhD students involved in research, although we do have a few what we call coursework PhDs, but these are the students who do the heavy lifting in terms of, you know, a lot of the research projects, mm-hmm. and a lot of the teaching as well of students. So in the past decade or so, 4 out of 5 extra doctoral students that we've had or that we've recruited in Australia, basically we've imported them from overseas. They've come largely from Asian countries, probably primarily China and to a lesser degree India. They're really outnumbering their domestic equivalents in areas like engineering and information technology, probably no surprises there.
Mm-hmm.
But also they've really surged in science generally, and also in management and commerce. So essentially leaving the domestic students to dominate the humanities and social sciences. And I suppose there are a lot of concerns around this. One of the big concerns that he expresses is the likelihood of a lot of these people will go home and take a lot of Australian research expertise with them. You know, it's quite logical and appropriate for a lot of these people to go home, although I'm sure they'll be very welcome to stay here if they want to. But it means where a lot of the training we're doing, the training of our serious researchers, are people who are, you know, unlikely to be here being part of our research community. So that's a problem for Australia.
Mm. And has there been any sort of pushback on a national level of perhaps opportunities not being extended to domestic students over foreign students? Has there been any reaction like that?
Look, I mean, there are comments to the, you know, I've heard comments that basically to the point that universities aren't interested in domestic students, that they want foreigners because they bring in more money.
Mm.
But it's complicated. You know, this whole area of funding of PhD students is complicated because they're not always necessarily paying fees. You know, there's scholarships involved, things like that. It's not as clear-cut as the domestic sort of reliance, or as the undergraduate sort of push for international students who are always paying fees, you know, sort of almost always paying fees and very, very, very healthy fees for the courses here. The high degree by research sort of environment is a little bit more complicated. And there's a cultural issue here at play, which again will resonate in North America and Europe, that a lot of people, you know, a lot of locals don't want to do these really sciencey, you know, sort of maths-heavy PhDs. Out of all the PhD students I know, top of my head, I can only think of one who's doing a, you know, engineering and science-related PhD. Most people are gravitating towards the humanities. So it is it's a cultural preference that we have. It's a cultural thing, and it's obviously going to be a difficult thing for us to deal with. It's, you know, you can't always blame the universities for who they recruit. They can only recruit from the willing comers, and unfortunately Australia just isn't providing that many STEM PhD candidates.
We've got the Research Excellence Summit coming up next week, the 19th through the 21st February, and the theme there is research for the public good. You're chairing a couple of sessions there in Sydney. What are you looking at as you kind of the lead up to it and your preparation for that?
Well, there's going to be a lot of great talkers from Australia region, people coming in from places like Hong Kong and all over the place, really. And, you know, obviously it's a great opportunity to showcase some of the local researchers. And, you know, UNSW, which is hosting the summit, has some really good ones. You know, we've been talking already about Michelle Simmons. One of the sessions I'm really looking forward to will involve sort of an Australian guru in the whole area of solar voltaics, a guy who can sort of lay claim largely to getting the whole solar panel industry going, you know, ranging from the little panels that a lot of Australia's houses these days have on their roofs, right up to the large-scale sort of solar farms that are sort of sprouting up in the inland plains mm-hmm. of Australia, where there's lots and lots of space and lots of sun. I think Australia's only just starting to realise that it's actually starting to be quite a player in this whole game. I heard on the news just the other day that I think Australia's been installing these sort of solar plants at about four times the rate of the world average. So mm-hmm. we're really catching on.
And that's Martin Green you're talking about.
Yeah, this is Martin Green. Yep. Sorry, I forgot to give you his name. Yeah, one of my friends came over here from Europe basically to breathe the same air as Martin Green, to be head of a school actually at UNSW for a while. But this guy has legend status in the field. He's a real straight talker, and I interviewed him a few weeks ago, and it was a really encouraging message he was giving, because he said, you know, he'd really had reservations about whether, you know, I don't think he's ever had reservations about the technology, but he's had reservations about whether the policy would capitalize on the technology to the extent required to contain climate change in any sort of way. And this is something that's becoming a real issue now for Australians and, you know, people all over the world, because, you know, we're at the tail end now of a real stinker of a summer. It's been really hot, new records being set, and, you know, we're really looking at the new norm.
What is Green saying? Yeah, is he saying that policy is going to eventually catch up with technology?
He's saying economics is going to push policy. He's saying the uptake of this technology is just really going bananas. And he's talking about some of the economic drivers, they call them bids, where large-scale power producers basically tender to produce power for some government authority over the next 15 or 20 years. He was talking about a solar company in Saudi Arabia that had put in some bid. I think it was something in less than two cents per kilowatt hour. I could have the figures wrong, but it was something along those lines. And this was way lower than anything anybody had seen before, and way lower than anything that you could possibly do with a coal-fired power station. There's a, you know, some elements of the polity here are very much wedded to coal, which is our second biggest export, a huge earner in Australia. But people are terribly worried about not only the climate change impacts of coal, burning coal, but also the health impacts. You know, cardiovascular is the biggest killer and so forth. So there's a lot of benefits in switching to renewables that have no emissions. You know, he's saying the economics is just going to drive this. It used to be that solar was considered unreliable. You have to pay extra for the loans. Now the opposite is the case.
Yeah.
You know, we're just seeing huge change, a huge push towards solar. And that's, you know, I don't think anybody's pretending that climate change is going to go away, but he's optimistic that potentially this could really influence the policy and maybe keep us toward, you know, towards less scary end of some of the predictions for the end of the century rather than the most terrifying ones. So that was very encouraging to me. I'm really looking forward to hearing Martin Green talk.
Yeah, great. Well, I won't take up too much of your Monday night, John. Thanks very much for that.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of people over here in Australia.
And that was THE's Asia-Pacific editor, John Ross. Ana Deletic, originally from Belgrade, is a world-renowned engineering academic and winner of the prestigious Victoria Prize for Science and Innovation. We started out talking about how to do research for the public good, which, by the way, is the topic of Times Higher Education's Research Excellence Summit being held at UNSW next week, February 19th through the 21st. Here's what Ana had to say. Anna, at the Research Excellence Summit that your institution, the University of New South Wales, is hosting next week, the topic is research for the public good. And so my question is, whenever we're looking at this vast list of global challenges, I'm thinking of the Sustainable Development Goals, for example, how should that be tackled? Should it be kind of like a top three priorities that people should focus on? Is that the right way of doing it, kind of prioritizing them, or is there another way?
These are very complex issues, and they do require an interdisciplinary approach in partnership between researchers and industry and society and communities as well. So I would just like to use water, which is my personal research area. I believe that huge issues we are facing in that space would be tackled only with different type of researchers, like basically engineers, natural sciences, as well as medical researchers, and definitely social science and governance researchers, all working together, but not in isolation, but working together with governments as well as with industry in partnership to make impact, so that the latest solutions which researchers discover can be implemented in practice and can be implemented in a fast way and in a efficient way, because we do need to work together to tackle these very complex issues.
And there are very complex issues, and I'm just wondering if, because water is your expertise, would it be safe to, well, I'd be interested to hear if there are, like, I don't know, top three global challenges that you think researchers or scientists should really be focusing on?
Actually, sustainability goals that you mentioned are very good example of where we should go for. I personally believe that climate change is the biggest problem that we are facing, and it's definitely public good related. And if we don't solve this problem, we may be in big trouble even in 30, 40 years. So this definitely for me is number one. You will then have issues which kind of relates to that, but they're still different, like water, for example, and particularly in developing world. It is a right for everyone to have clean water and enjoy a safe and clean environment. But even countries which are going through huge transition are struggling at least with environmental challenges, and definitely developing countries are struggling with clean water issues. And with flooding coming due to climate change, developed countries, are in big trouble as well. So wherever you look, we are having these issues related to water. But another one, again, related to climate change in certain ways, is energy. If we want to combat the problem of climate change, we need to find better ways of delivering energy, not using, you know, fossil fuels. So for me, these three are huge.
I'm wondering also how you feel these efforts on the part of researchers like yourself are interpreted by the wider society, and if you think that there's a disconnect there between the work that you're doing and how that's actually interpreted by them.
I'm an optimist. I believe that that if we communicate well and work very closely with industry and government practice, that we can get far ahead. I believe that it's our actually duty to be engaged with wider community. But it's not always easy. And some challenges that we are facing is also governments are not always open to long-term investments. You know, governments, at least in the world where I live and very likely you live, they are 4 years more than that, and that's a huge issue for some of these public good challenges, because, for example, climate change, it's intergenerational problem, and unless any government thinks of what's going to happen in 30 years, we are not going to solve it. So I think that may be the biggest challenge we have from that point of view, but from a researcher's point of view, the biggest challenge maybe lies in the fact that we are not always the best communicators. We are all not always, we don't always understand the need for, I call it popularization of science. Also, and that's where our, I think, main fault is. And you know, if we can solve these two issues, I think we can get very far. But for me, these are the two main challenges. The research community is not the best in communicating and engaging with community and governments, and at the same time, governments are often very short-sighted.
Right.
So these two things don't go together very well.
Okay. I'm also wondering if the state of universities today, with all of their bureaucracy and processes, I'm also wondering if that is having an impact on researchers' ability to really be innovative and give them space to have that real blue skies thinking. Is that kind of weighted down by the current role of a researcher now in the modern university?
I agree with you. There's lots of that. I'm pro vice chancellor research. My job is to look after that bureaucracy. But at the same time, I have to honestly say we don't have much choice. There are so many legal constraints that we are put under, put it this way. So we have to put these processes in place to assure that our institutions comply with all external legal requirements, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of processes are put in place, actually almost all of them, at least in my little sphere, because we have to, not because we want to, because you know, they come and review us, they constantly government, via public university, so government will obviously make sure that health and safety, not just health and safety, but all processes are really, it's about being risk averse and stuff like that. So we have to push that on researchers because we have no choice, otherwise we wouldn't comply. So that's the reason for increased bureaucracy. But the other problem that universities are facing is funding. So we are called public universities, but I don't know in your country, but in Australia, governments are investing less and less in universities. Actually, when you go and look, almost every year there is a cut and cut, particularly we just had a huge cut as a sector in research, and every year there is a cut. So it's not just that there is no increase, and, you know, there is the inflation as well, so no one cares about that, but there is absolutely a cut, so they're giving us less money. So that's a huge challenge, because for us to perform world-class research, we do need funds, and therefore researchers are spending more and more time chasing money than doing research, because it's very hard to get that money to run, do research. So that's a huge trend, which I see in lots of places, not just Australia, that efficiency of research going down because of huge effort we need to put in place to secure funds for research.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit to comment on just the uniqueness of Australia's position right now. I know where there are some funding cut announcements just before Christmas, and so you guys are kind of operating in a new landscape now. So what are your feelings about the future of research in Australia?
I'm hoping that the government will see the light, that our sector is actually very, very productive. I mean, there are some analyses which were done showing that every dollar they spent for research is multiplied several times through productivity of our industry and our in all public good that they receive. So I'm just hoping that the government will at some point see that these sort of cuts are, as they call it, are killing the golden goose, because it's very interesting that in Australia, universities are third biggest export industry. So we have mining. Everyone knows about Australian mining. We are so lucky country in that respect. We are very good in agriculture and being such a vast land, you can imagine, that these are natural resources which we have, being such a large country with so small population. But education is the third biggest export, and that's the first in service industries. That tells you that there is such a good opportunity for government to invest in us rather than to undermine us. But hopefully they'll see the light and see that apart from us providing world-class education, that all, at least a group of eight universities are often in the top 100 at any rankings, which shows that quality of research is very high, which attracts the international students, because international students would not be coming to Australian university unless we are very good in what we do.
My final question for you, and this is kind of related to an international topic, and it's open access. And I know that Australian funders are being pushed to consider joining Plan S, the European initiative for open access. And I'm just wondering if you think that is a good way to increase research's service to the public good by making it more open access.
I personally like it, but again, Australia is such a small country related to the vast amount of papers that are now produced, particularly in China and also in Europe and, of course, in the US, that we can't sway this big debate. As an editor of one of the best water research journals, I can tell you that we are all in publishing world, we are all changing our practice, and there are now more and more open access journals which are good quality. There was a problem even a few years ago that open access journals were not at the standard of well-established old journals, I'll call it old, but been around for a long time. And that was one of the problems that the Australian community was facing. I'm hoping that as its open access journal community grows, and particularly grows in quality, not quantity, because there are so many predatory open access journals, that'll, you know, as the quality increases and prestige of publishing those increases, the Australian research community will jump on the wagon. But I think us being so small is another issue why it's very hard for us to start trends. It's UK and UK, EU and America can afford that. We are so small, we don't make a big difference on the world level in that sense, if you know what I mean. It's the volume.
It'll be interesting to see how that develops then. Anna, that's about it for my questions. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Sarah, and thanks for doing this. Okay, bye.
And that was Anna Deletic, Pro Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of New South Wales. If you're in Sydney next week, you should check out our Research Excellence Summit. And if you're not, you can, of course, follow along on Twitter and timeshighereducation.com. I'm Sarah Custer. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.